A baby is born every 1.4 seconds, according to the Bureau of Statistics. This growing population consumes more, uses more resources, takes up more space. So it's important to preserve the limited resources and land which we depend on so much. National President of Sustainable Population Australia, James Ward, joins us now for a chat about it. Good morning, James.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And many people say our consumption patterns rather than population size impacts the environment, but you have a different school of thought.
Well, I wouldn't say that consumption is not part of it, but I think what we have to do is multiply our per capita consumption with the number of people. I mean, if we are concerned about the footprint that we're making on the planet or on this continent, we need to also be concerned about the number of feet.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the government uses the gross domestic product, or GDP, to gauge economic success. What do you think the downfalls of this measurement are?
Well, the GDP, the best way to think about it, if you bear with me for an analogy, imagine your bank statement that we get electronically now rather than paper, but at the top of your bank statement it says, you know, in the last quarter you received $1,000 and you spent $1,000, or in my case, it always seems to have a miraculous way of spending more than the money that came in. But that one number that says, you know, this is how much money came through your bank account, is just a single number. Now, if your bank account says $1,000 and my bank account says $2,000, according to GDP theory, I'm better off than you by a factor of two, because GDP just lumps all transactions for our economy into a single aggregate statistic, which is how much money is there flowing around. Now, if taking that example, if I'm spending most of that money on, say, my car breaking down, or a higher mortgage because of housing affordability, or medical expenses, or some other things, then I'm not necessarily better off. And so the problem with GDP at an economy scale is that it aggregates absolutely everything. And if we're spending more money as a society on prisons and divorce lawyer fees and environmental cleanups and all sorts of bad things like that, it is reflected positively in the GDP. And what we need to do is we need to actually do what any respectable accountant would do, which is separate the costs and the income. And we need to say, okay, here are the components of the GDP that are good. These represent things that we like. So more leisure time, for example, would be a good thing. And here are the things that that we don't really like, and we have to count them off as though they're costs. And so if you net off the costs from the income, you have a truer measure, or net off the bads from the goods, really. You have a truer measure of how well we're doing as an economy.
Right. And is this the GPI, Genuine Progress Indicator, that you've written
about?
Yes,
that's right. So one example, in our conversation article, we referred to the GPI, and that's been developed by other people over a number of years, and that attempts to do exactly what I just described. So it nets off the bad things from the good things, and it gives you a much smaller number than the GDP, but it's a truer reflection of how well we're doing. And more importantly, it allows us to track whether we are getting better over time. Because obviously, if you track GDP over time, then as we learned a few weeks ago, Australia has now enjoyed some astonishing number of years of successive GDP growth. And so it looks like, according to that crude measure, we're getting better and better and better. But if we look at the GPI over time, when we subtract off the costs, we discover that, in fact, the costs have grown faster than the benefits, and we are actually going backwards in terms of our net well-being. And you can trace it right back. These calculations have been done with data available going back over four decades, and we find that, in fact, we've basically been having no net improvement in well-being since about the mid-1970s.
Wow.
So that gives you a scientific basis for nostalgia for anyone listening who was around in the 1970s. I actually wasn't, but I certainly know a number of people who do reflect on those times and think that Australia was a better place.
Yeah, I suppose unless you're in a minority group, but isn't it kind of subjective? How do you, like, who determines what's good and bad?
That's true. It is, and again, any time where you're trying to summarise the entire well-being of a society in a single number, there are going to be flaws with that metric. And in this case, yes, the scientists who've come up with the GPI, and I believe that if you trace it back, it's attributable to the economist Herman Daly. But no doubt one of your listeners will correct us if I'm wrong with that. He was an ecological economist, and produced his seminal work was The Steady State Economy, looking at a system of economics that doesn't require ongoing growth every year. So anyway, the GPI includes about a couple of dozen different indicators, including things like environmental pollution, as I mentioned, leisure time being in the good column, and environmental damage, depletion of resources, crime. But it also values good things. So I've mentioned leisure time now a couple of times, but housework and volunteering and things like that, which are not even captured in the GDP. But it also measures the things like the life expectancy of consumer goods. So that's, if we have longer lasting goods, then we're going to create less waste and things like that. But as you said, it's subjective in terms of if we want to count more things in the good column and less things in the bad column, or the other way around, then we can affect the outcome. Mm. But I think as long as we make those methods clear and transparent, then at least it's doing what it claims to do, which is provide an alternative measure to just GDP, which is all we seem to hear about in the mainstream.
And do you think, I mean, a lot of that comes down to our obsession and ingrained sort of relationship with capitalism and how the money and the economy really drives much of what we do, particularly in relation to policy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that the people who benefit from a growing GDP are probably a small elite, and the people who don't benefit from GDP are probably the majority. So from a growing GDP, I should say. So I think that we have a government which is basically serving the interests of a small number of probably corporate interests, and they're pushing for ongoing growth in this thing which they tell us a rising tide lifts all boats and metaphors like that, when in fact we know really that this rising tide is lifting up the luxury yachts. And everybody else is still tied to the pier.
So, I mean, how much, do policymakers take this seriously? Is there a legitimate move towards a genuine progress indicator?
There is, yeah. This is not just something that academics talk about, although we'd like to see more uptake of it. But I think that there is, even at the very highest levels, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals are a good indicator that we are moving in the right direction, in that we're expanding beyond just considering GDP in our measures of human progress. But even at more local scales, there's a government in the United States, in Maryland, they have actually adopted GPI as their as one of their measures of sort of reporting on their society's well-being. So that's something that we'd love to see the state government in South Australia take up the GPI. Obviously, we wouldn't be arguing for them to reject GDP, because that tells us some important things about the size of the economy. But to have have that complemented by a measure like GPI would be fantastic.
Mm. Do you think it kind of goes hand in hand with livability? We do hear a lot about how awesome Adelaide is these days in relation to the livability of the city. It sounds kind of familiar.
Absolutely. So I think that we have these consistent scores where Australian cities are performing very, very well in terms of livability, and the GPI, whilst it's not really gone up since the 1970s, it's not like it's crashed down to the floor. So Adelaide was probably fairly livable in the 70s. As you say, there were sort of social issues that for minority groups that things are much better today, and hopefully will continue to get better. But in terms of the livability, the breathability of the air, the congestion on the roads, a city like Adelaide has a lot of advantages, and if we strive for a higher growth rate in our population, we'll end up with more congestion and more pollution, and we will ultimately sacrifice that livability.
Mm. James Ward, National President of Sustainable Population Australia, is with us. Let's talk more about that. We hear it sounds as though a lot of people and policymakers are obsessed with growth. Is it really damaging that we are always trying to get more people, more consumption here in Australia, in South Australia?
Yeah, well, I guess it depends what side of the fence you're on. And if you're a property developer who makes a lot of money every time a piece of rural land is rezoned for housing, then more growth is a very good thing, and you're probably cushioned from the impacts of that if you're making lots and lots of money, because you probably are able to live in some luxurious dwelling somewhere. And if you're making money selling refrigerators or washing machines, then you probably do very well out of the growing population as well. And again, you're probably making plenty of money and you're cushioned from the impacts. But for the rest of us, we feel the impact of growing population and the push that our government has. Now, South Australia, it's true, has a low population growth rate relative to Australia, but it's worth mentioning that Australia has a high population growth rate relative to other developed countries, and we're growing it nationally at a quite an alarming rate, really.
Mm. So what do you think we need to do to, you know, try to address these issues of having alarming population rises?
Sure. This is where we start to get into, this is where the conversation always starts to put people off, because population it's actually very simple. It either comes from having more births than deaths, or it comes from having net migration from other countries. So in Australia, we've got about 45% of our increase in population comes from what's called natural increase, which is the difference between births and deaths. And at the moment, births outnumber deaths about 2-1. And the other 55% approximately comes from net overseas migration. So that's the difference between how many Australians permanently migrate out of Australia and how many permanently migrate into Australia. So This gives us very few levers that we can pull that the government can pull at a policy level in order to affect change in the population. You can have, based on those three parameters, you can either have fewer births, and people don't like the sound of that. You can have more deaths, and people definitely don't like the sound of that. And I definitely am not advocating a higher death rate. Or you can have less migration, less net overseas migration, and that then raises all sorts of red flags with people. So we've got limited things, but I would say that in that context, a lot of people are very, very rightly concerned about the plight of refugees. Refugees make up a very small fraction of our total net migration, about 12,000 per year.
Right, so they've been a bit of a scapegoat.
And our total net overseas migration is somewhere in the realm of 250,000, 20 times that. So we could very comfortably accommodate a larger intake of refugees, and I think we should take on many more refugees than we do, and we can do our bit in terms of a humanitarian agenda, whilst still reducing the total number of migrants coming to the country, if we actually want to stabilise our population. And I think that part of this is that we need to have an upfront, what would a politician say, a full and frank discussion about population, because I think too often they look at that, they say, well, you're either going to end up talking about fertility or you're going to end up talking about migration. Either way, you're going to put off most of the people listening, and we're not going to talk about it. And I think we actually need to be open about this. We need to say, well, we've got 24.5 million people on a continent which is mostly desert. Most of the arable land is being farmed as much as it can be, and in some cases it's degrading. The water supplies are basically at capacity in terms of the urban population. We're building desalination plants and things like that. do we, at this point, want to maintain a high population growth rate, one of the highest in the OECD, and see if we can push that 24.5 million up to 50 million and see how livable our cities are then? Or do we want to start having that conversation now and say, well, maybe if we're really smart, we can cause that to level off at closer to 30 million. And we'll still have livability issues in Melbourne and Sydney and congestion issues in those cities, but maybe we can actually maintain most of what we've currently got in Australia if we have that conversation now. But if we keep sweeping it under the carpet and we have this conversation in 30 or 40 years' time and our population is twice what it is, then I think that won't benefit anyone.
Well, you've certainly got your work cut out for you. Thanks so much for joining us, James.
Thank you very much for your time.
He's the National President of Sustainable Population Australia, lecturer in Water and Environmental Engineering at the University of South Australia as well, James Ward.